Shrink Wrap Radio number 643, The Cutting Edge of Neurotech, with neuropsychologist Graham Moffitt, PhD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Graham Moffitt, who, among a host of other things, is a neuropsychologist and neurotechnologist and chief scientist at Interoxon, maker of the Muse Brain Scanning Headband. We'll be discussing his work generally, as well as the upgraded Muse 2. For more information about Dr. Graham Moffitt, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Graham Moffitt, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm always interested in talking to psychology and neuroscience and mental health professionals who are really interested in sort of where the cutting edge of technology in our space is going.
That is exactly what I'm interested in. I've even titled this episode something about the cutting edge of neurotechnology, something like that. I don't even remember the title. I don't have it in front of me. But I'm really excited to speak to you because I did interview Ariel Garten, the founder of Muse, the Muse brain scanning headband, and have been using one. It was about a year ago that I interviewed her, and I've used it not as consistently as I would hope, but I've used it I've had some good long runs with it, and
one of the most interesting things we've learned is that technology, most people who are interested in technology for mindfulness or for mental health don't want that to become a crutch for them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a lot of people who use Muse will use it for spurts of weeks or months, and then they'll drop off and then they'll come back. And I think it's part of the benefit is from reestablishing habits. No matter how good you are at establishing healthy practices, getting a sort of a booster shot or a reinvigoration of your habits is always helpful. And where technology can help, that's where it can benefit, I think, mental health the most.
Yeah, good. And we'll be talking about Muse more, and particularly the Muse 2, which has just recently come out. I want to back up a bit before we get into that, because you have had such a fascinating career and are a very interesting person to me, because I watched you and Ariel in a recent TEDx presentation. And so tell us a little bit about your background, just kind of the, not too much time, but to give us a little bit of your background before you came to Muse.
Happy to. I'm the chief scientist here at Interoxon, the company that makes Muse. I came to this to a degree, I wouldn't say by accident, but I came to it from a unique path that I haven't heard a lot of people getting into neurofeedback, biofeedback, this kind of neurotechnology, and specifically mindfully focused neurotechnology. So my background is I've trained as a physicist in undergraduate in my first university degree. Went on to do experimental psychophysics with Larry Roberts and Laurel Trainer at McMaster University, and I think one of the better auditory perception and neuroplasticity labs in the world. Then moved on to animal physiology, looking for treatments for neuroplasticity gone wrong, I guess you'd say, in the cortex. So there are a number of ways in which, we tend to think of neuroplasticity, in the popular sense at least, as something that's beneficial. It helps you recover from injury. It helps your brain stay young. But neuroplasticity really in its purest sense just means, the changing and the plasticity of the brain. And that can go in some interesting ways. One of the most famous ways that it can go wrong is Ramachandran's example of phantom limb pain. So, there are these parts of the brain that are attuned to parts of the body, and when someone loses a limb or a body part, they can feel this sensation of pain associated with the body part, even though the body part is absent. That's
right.
That's a form of neuroplasticity that's, I guess you'd say, maladaptive. And my early work in grad school and beyond was on tinnitus and looking at what happened in the cortex of mammals after a traumatic noise injury or hearing loss. And so moved from there into working in scientific communication, where I ran Frontiers in Neuroscience, which I think is still the largest or second largest open access journal series in the field of neuroscience. From there, moved into AI and some machine learning stuff. And when I'd been running Frontiers in Neuroscience, the funny thing happened. It was right around the time that mindfulness and the neuroscience of mindfulness really seeped into the mainstream of neuroscience. So for a long time, I think it had been on the fringes. And the work of Richie Davidson and Sarah Lazar and Judd Brewer and some of these, you know, well-known personalities of the neuroscience of mindfulness really sort of broke through into the scientific the neuroscience mainstream. We published a special issue at Frontiers in Neuroscience that was edited by Amishi Jha and some colleagues. And Amishi is also quite a well-known neuroscience researcher who does extensive work on attention and mindfulness. And I was reading all these papers thinking, boy, I had better be practicing meditation, because this seems to be almost too good to be true. You know, this is really, really beneficial for brain health. And so I really struggled to figure out how to do that, because this was in the days before, this is about 2011, this is in the days before Headspace, this is in the days before there were all kinds of meditation guides on YouTube. And when you're living in a relatively small and remote part of the world, there's not a lot of meditation teachers around. So when I encountered the group at Interaxon, Ariel and Chris and the founders, and had the opportunity to come and work here on something that married, you know, this fascination I had with mindfulness and meditation, with the sort of technical skill that I had developed as a neuroscientist, I jumped at the chance, and I've been here for 4.5 years working on not just the neuroscience of mindfulness and meditation with Muse, but how we can sort of push the envelope of what electroencephalography and what this technology can do in a variety of applications outside of the laboratory and in the real world.
Yeah, I think you'll understand how fascinating and exciting this is for me, because way back in 1970, I did my doctoral dissertation on the role of attention in meditation and hypnosis. I had no tools to measure the brain, so I asked people to click a clicker every time they had to bring their attention back from following their breath or staring at a candle. So and that, things, you know, have moved forward amazingly since then.
They haven't, to a degree, they haven't. You know, one of the things you'll notice is if you go and look at the literature on neuroscience of mindfulness, some of the tasks that are used for the measurement of mind wandering and attention are still very much those kinds of self-reported either clicker or button. There are some clever new permutations of those classic experiments and classic paradigms using some more readily available technology that, you know, it's more easily accessible now, I'd say. You can do this outside of a laboratory. You can do this in, you know, you can do this remotely on people's smartphones.
I may have originated the clicker. I think,
and that paradigm is still used today. The self-caught mind wandering paradigm. Is still widely used in attention and mindfulness research.
That's amazing.
And the same is true, interestingly, of EEG and neurofeedback. One way to think of Muse is that as a neurofeedback or a biofeedback assisted meditation learning tool. It, among other things, it, you know, it could be construed as that. And the fascinating part about neurofeedback and biofeedback is that it became popular in the late 60s, early 70s, even maybe into the 80s a little bit. But then there was a collapse in research interest in the field, due in part to the overselling of the promise and the potential benefits, and in part due to some controversies around the robustness of the findings. And it really sort of waned until the 90s when it came back, starting in Germany and then later in the US and elsewhere. And then waned, and EEG kind of waxed and waned along with that, for a variety of reasons. You know, we went from 20 channel systems to 64 to 128 channel systems. And then we got to precise time lock stimulus presentation, where we could do different paradigms with that. And then we got much more powerful computers and more powerful statistical techniques for looking at where in the brain these electrical sources were originated. And then we moved on to analyzing how networks of different sources interacted, and came up with models for that based on other parts of the field of neuroscience. So bringing what we knew about what we've known about neuroscience now for some number of decades into the field of EEG has really potentiated a wide variety of new uses for the technology. And I'd say that there's a researcher I really admire, Brad Wojtek at the University of California, San Diego, who set as one of his goals in the last few years to revivify the field of EEG research, and I think it's really succeeded. There's a real interest now in a very wide community of researchers in using EEG for things that it classically could be used for, but also using new techniques of analysis to look deeper into the signals and pull out some more insights.
Wow, I wasn't aware of any of that, that biofeedback had kind of gone out of fashion for a while and is now being reborn.
So we're on the third wave of biofeedback now, yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah, fascinating. So yeah. That kind of leads into another thing that I wanted to ask you about, which is enabling technologies. Like, clearly you've been talking about some of the technologies that have enabled what's now the state of the art today in terms of brain training and so on. And I'm wondering if there are technologies on the horizon that you see or are hoping for that might move the ball even further.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, the big thing that has potentiated a lot of what's really advancing things, at least in terms of the research side, is open science and open source software. So that's really blown the doors open on what people can do, the kind of software tool they can access. You know, a lot of things are free now that used to be very costly. Electroencephalography has come down in price from, it would have cost you $50,000 or $100,000 to get any system 20 years ago to where now you can get a Muse for $200, $249, something like that, depending on where you are and what model you get. And that is due in part to the proliferation of the supercomputers we carry around in our pockets that we call smartphones.
More powerful computers than they had when they sent people to the moon.
That's
mind blowing.
It is amazing. When you think about what we use these things for and how powerful the computers are, it sometimes seems a bit ridiculous. But the two big things that were potentiated by the arrival of the smartphone were that it enabled the remote and portable processing of very complex data sets, like electroencephalography, in real time to a degree as well, so that you could create experiences on that basis that would be portable biofeedback and neurofeedback. And not just that, but you could use the way that we have designed games and interactions on smartphones to really improve the experience in such a way that it's compelling and easy to use for anyone. And the other is that just the proliferation of smartphone technology has created these enormous supply chains of very low cost electronic components, which is one of the reasons why we were able to build Muse in volume for hundreds of dollars instead of thousands or tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, it's remarkable that I can remember that biofeedback devices, because I was interested in biofeedback as well, in the early days of biofeedback, and it would cost a lot of money, thousands of dollars, to get any kind of a biofeedback device. Yeah, and now for under $200, Muse.
That's right, that'll keep dropping. I think it'll steadily decrease in price as the technology becomes cheaper and better. In 10 years, we might see an EEG system for tens of dollars. I think that's an entirely conceivable, like a good EEG system that might cost you $50 or less.
Yeah. Now,
so that,
going back
sorry,
to enabling technologies, what about virtual reality, augmented reality? Do you see that as being?
Yeah, and you would know probably better than I do about the applications, the wide range of applications for virtual and augmented reality in therapy.
Actually, I don't.
Therapy.
I don't think I do know.
There's quite a. I think we're still in the early days. But there's now a dedicated field of medicine and of mental health that's looking very hard at what we can use virtual reality for effectively in improving patients' quality of life, whether they're in hospital, in the ICU, or something like that, or in long-term care, or remote administration of exposure therapy in virtual reality. One of the things that's neat about these systems is that they're still pretty bulky. Hopefully they'll get smaller in the future, but they're still pretty bulky right now. And that means that there's a lot of stuff going on around the head. You have to wrap this thing on.
Yeah.
And that means that you have all of these contact points on the head where you can put biosensors like EEG or functional near infrared spectroscopy or galvanic skin response or any number of things. And incorporating real-time biosignals into virtual reality for, neuroadaptive interfaces. Interfaces that you can imagine, for example, would dial up or down the intensity of an experience or the attentional load experienced by a user on the basis of whether what they were able to attend to and what their what the evoked responses in these biosignals showed us about what they were attending to and what they were experiencing. So I think there's real potential here for some very compelling experiences in virtual and augmented reality that are driven by real-time, what they call neuroadaptive interfaces. So rather than a direct, you're trying to control an object by thinking, this is something that sits in the background and just adapts the interface and adapts the software or the game or the experience or whatever it is to keep it at a level that is engaging but not overwhelming. And then you can adjust that accordingly.
You're reminding me, actually, I said I didn't know anything about that, but you're reminding me that I interviewed Skip Rizzo,
yeah,
of USC, who was an early user of this kind of technology for soldiers.
Absolutely, he's one of the pioneers in this field, and still to this day is one of the leaders. And there are others like Walter Greenleaf at Stanford and Brennan Spiegel at I think he's at Cedar Sinai. There are a bunch of people now who are doing really good work that have they host a conference at Cedar Sinai every year that's just a fantastic sort of world leading thing for the development and testing and deployment and best practices around the use of virtual reality in medicine and healthcare.
Yeah, and another sort of related area is and that you refer to in your TEDx presentation was learning to use thought control to control physical devices, what's at the really cutting edge right now?
That's a really interesting one because a lot of people had sort of been hoping that we would have a non-invasive way of using electroencephalography or some wearable head-worn system to be able to control a software interface or a machine just by thinking something. And it turns out that it's probably going to be possible to do that non-invasively. Certainly it's possible to do it with surgically implanted invasive electrodes. But that's a very limited case. It turns out it is possible to do this, but probably not with EEG in the way that people had hoped. The way that this seems to really be the most promising application for active brain-computer interfaces and brain-controlled software, is using electromyography. So muscle activity in the forearm. If you put a bunch of electrodes around the forearm, almost like a wristband, you can use machine learning and you can use neuroplasticity as people learn how to interact with this interface to get very, very high fidelity control over hands and limbs in virtual reality. You can even with training, you can add fingers to someone's interface so they can be typing with 8 fingers on each hand after some amount of practice in a virtual setting. And the way that this is done is
8 fingers?
So yeah, there's a really great, there's a great company in New York, Control Labs, that does this. And what they do is, they measure, impulses in the muscles in the forearm. And you can learn through practice and through training with this interface to control, single motor units in the forearm. So very, very fine control. And that allows you to have, a degree of control in software without moving your hand that, you know, gives you a complete control of a virtual or a hand in a virtual space. And then you can extend from there to a hand that has more digits than your own because you can control, you know, you have this degree of control, in virtual space. So, it really is a fascinating field of research just for not only for virtual reality and for brain computer interfaces, but also as a model for understanding motor learning and neuroplasticity.
Wow. In your presentation, your TEDx presentation, you mentioned that Elon Musk has moved into this space, creating a division or a company called Neuralink. What can you tell us about what he's up to? What does he hope to achieve?
I wish I could tell you what they're up to. You hear only rumors about what goes on in inside Neuralink and some of these well-financed, we'll call them, I guess, a company or neurotechnology research and development shops. They're a really genuinely positive development for the field. I think for mental health, and I think for neural rehabilitation and a variety of different applications. It's a really, really good thing that Facebook and Elon Musk and Brian Johnson are digging into, you know, the brain as a potential technology interface and trying to really pour resources at solving problems in a focused way that is very often difficult to do for publicly funded research. So, not very much gets out from what Neuralink and some of these places are up to, but it's going to be exciting to see when they finally decide to reveal what they've been working on, just how far they've gotten. You know, wow. Some of the best scientists in the world are working now with resources, levels of funding that I think were unavailable or are unavailable to most neuroscientists out there working in publicly funded and academic institutions.
Well, this raises the question in my mind about the quotes, the singularity, the idea that this technology, that computers will eventually outpace us cognitively and then maybe take over. You've mastered more of this technology or more of an insider than anybody else I've spoken to. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I don't know if I'm that much of an insider compared to some of the AI scientists out there who, are neck deep in AI research. But, it's a question for cognitive science as to, you know, how thinking works and are computers going to have the same kind of cognition or a comparable cognition to the way that humans think? There's not particularly any reason to believe that they will. So it could be a completely different kind of thinking than what we have even imagined to be thinking or reasoning. To a degree, what we've mostly done with artificial intelligence to date has been to do, human tasks, try to get computers to do human-like tasks at a human-like level of performance. So whether it's speech comprehension or object recognition in an image or those kinds of things. And we're pretty impressed by those, but, where it starts to get even more interesting is, when you get these AIs learning very complex games and very complex, strategy system, that's a fascinating field. Where I am not necessarily, I think, on the same page as a lot of, enthusiasts of the singularity, we'll say, is I think we have a very long way to go before we can interface with the human brain in a way that allows us to communicate meaningfully with computers via, a neurobiological interface to, or an electronic interface to a brain.
Yeah.
there's a lot going on in the human brain. And just tapping in, even 10,000 electrodes in a brain is going to capture a very small part of the information processing that's happening in that brain.
Right.
Well, there's Christoph Koch from the Allen Institute likes to say that, you know, the roundworm C. elegans has, or I guess it's flatworm, has 302 neurons, and we still don't really know how this thing works. And the human brain has billions of neurons, tens of billions of neurons, and we're probably a very long way from really getting a grasp. So I think there's a lot of enthusiasm, and that's great, but I'm not so sure that in our lifetimes we're going to see a full comprehensive understanding of how the human brain works.
Okay. Now, you've done a lot of research on the use of this brain technology in with meditation. And so what's the evidence that neurotech can help with with meditation?
Yeah, I think I should there's a caveat here that I think a lot of people who look at Muse will say, well, I don't need this in order to meditate. Why would I need technology in order to meditate? And if that's true for you, then that's absolutely correct. If you can if you already know how to meditate and you have a healthy meditation practice that you're happy with, you don't need a Muse. If you find technology interesting and you want to try a new experience, and maybe get new insight, then it could be for you. The technology is really designed, principally for beginners who really struggle. As you know, based on your doctoral research, people really don't know when their mind is wandering, unless they're experienced meditators. And that's one of the reasons why meditators are so fascinating to cognitive scientists and cognitive neuroscientists is they have this degree of control over mind wandering and a metacognition, a meta awareness of their cognitive processes that few other people do. So someone who has that kind of powerful control over cognition is a fascinating subject for cognitive science. The beginner, in contrast to an expert meditator, will tend to not recognize that their mind has wandered for minutes or even tens of minutes after they've gone into either a ruminative or a daydreaming kind of process. And so what we've designed Muse to do, and it was quite by accident that we got here, but what we've designed Muse to do now is to help people recognize mind wandering and to train them to recognize it themselves through auditory feedback based on their electroencephalogram. So you pop this thing on your head, and it sends signals to your smartphone, and the EEG is processed on the smartphone. It's turned into a soundscape, so a virtual auditory soundscape, and that may be a city park, it may be a rainforest, it may be a beach, you can choose whatever you like. And there are instruction sets as well that go along with this to teach different meditation practices. So from that, you get these cues when your mind wanders away from a focused state to bring your attention back to your breath, or to bring your attention back to your sensation of breath, or excuse me, whatever it is you've chosen to focus on. So that really is the core value of the technology, and that takes quite a lot of practice for most people.
I would say it's really such a leap beyond beyond my doctoral research that I referred to earlier, because it was confounded by just what you're pointing out, that not everybody is going to be terribly sensitive to when their mind wanders. They may be off for some time on a journey before they kind of remember, I'm supposed to press a button now, I guess.
that's exactly right. Experienced meditators will do that right away. You'll get more button presses from them, and they have more control over when they let their minds wander. Uh-huh. So really just getting beginners to establish this practice and recognize when their mind has wandered. This is a core part of the technology behind Muse. Now, Muse 2 has a few more features beyond that, but that's really what the electroencephalography part of Muse was designed to do. And the reason we got to that, and this is a kind of a funny story, but we were actually trying to build something different. So the founders of the company were trying to build a way of controlling, as we discussed earlier, a way of controlling a computer interface by thinking about, you know, one thing or another. So the original goal was to move a mouse cursor in an augmented reality interface. And what the founders discovered when they were trying to learn how to control this thing is, you know, if you're trying to learn any kind of controlled complex task, excuse me, sorry. can find maybe, literally any kind of song.
With just my mind, I would be able to think copy and then paste.
And or move left and move right.
Yeah, and move the cursor over to here, you know, copy here and paste over there.
And it's very difficult to make that technology work. But what you can do by accident when you're trying to make it work is learn how to meditate. So meditators are much better, experienced meditators are much better at controlling brain-computer interfaces than non-meditators. Uh-huh. And even people who've been through an MBSR course will be much better at controlling brain-computer interfaces than novices. So this is a finding now that's been replicated a couple of times, and this is what we discovered by accident. Is in trying to build this tool for controlling a computer, we had accidentally taught ourselves meditation.
Wow. I hadn't heard that story when I interviewed Ariel. She didn't mention that.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
I think Ariel likes the story of us having done this quite intentionally. And that was where Ariel's story picks up, is when the team realized that they had a tool that was not in fact what it was designed to do, but it was an excellent way of teaching meditation or learning meditation by trying to use this tool. That became the sort of aha moment.
Yeah.
Where it was, there was a realization, wait a minute, we haven't built what we thought we were building, but we've built something that's potentially much more useful.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What do you call this field that we're talking about? Do you call it psych tech or?
We call it neurotechnology.
Neurotechnology, okay.
Yeah.
And there may be a leap between, you know, I'm thinking about the spiritual journey and, you know, I hear that you're not claiming that the spiritual journey is necessarily enhanced electronically.
I don't think that the spiritual journey is necessarily enhanced. I think the parts of this that are cognitive and attentional are definitely enhanced. The parts that have to do with establishing some of the basic cognitive skills required for to enable that spiritual journey for people who are seeking that, this can be a very helpful technology. Some of the research that we've done suggests that not only do we get this, you know, similar outcomes to, say, at least psychometric outcomes to a mindfulness-based stress reduction course or to a meditation retreat, but we see those within, you know, about 4 weeks of starting. If you muse every day for 15 or 20 minutes, we start to see some neuroplastic effects and some self-reported psychometric effects, similar to what meditators report, or novice meditators report in a course or in a retreat. We see those with home practice after about 4 weeks. So, the skills, and of course they continue to improve. And the other things that we see are augmentations of certain components of the EEG. So there's one way of analyzing EEG is to time lock to stimulus events and then play the same stimulus pretty repeatedly and every so often throw in an oddball stimulus. And the oddball prompts your attentional mechanisms to kick in and say, wait a minute, something's different there. So you can give somebody a task or you can just play a passive oddball stimulus, whether it's visual or auditory. And you see these components that respond specifically to that oddball. When you look at those in people who've used Muse for, say, 4 weeks, there's an augmentation of some of the cognitive elements of that, the P3 response, so about 300 milliseconds after the onset of the stimulus. And that suggests to us that the attentional resources of these people have been more, I guess, refined, you'd say. I have to choose my words carefully here. There's a neuroplastic effect that seems to suggest that there's an augmentation of the ability to notice change, which suggests that there's a change in the performance of attention in some of these tasks.
Yeah, I think, going way back again to my doctoral work, I really think that attention is such a key concept to lots of phenomena. So it's great that... Now, one of the magical things is because of the success of Muse and having sold lots of the devices, you're able to get very large data sets now, both for people who are interested in studying the effects of that kind of feedback on neuroplasticity and so on, as well as on meditation. and also health benefits. It puts me in mind of Apple.
One of the
Apple
really, really encouraging things about this is that we're able to get, I think, probably unprecedented scale in neuro data, electroencephalography data. And this will be true of other modalities of measuring the brain at some point as well. Because we have so many people out there using Muse who we ask them to share their data with us for research purposes, about, you know, 2/3 of them will say yes. Because a lot of these people who have adopted Muse in their practice are interested in technology and interested in the science of the brain. So when we look into these data, what we see is an enormous sample of people from, you know, age about 16 to 92. Well, that's a sample granularity that's never been seen before in electroencephalography. So we can see things that other scientists have reported on in really great detail. And we can look into components of attention. We can look into components that are related to age, gender. And we see these differences because of the enormous statistical power that falls out of a data set of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people and millions of sessions of EEG. So we're very, very fortunate that our users are enthusiastic about this and that they share their data with us. And we've done some great collaborations with the University of California, San Diego, with McMaster University, with the University of Toronto, and some other world-class universities on analyzing and digging into these and looking for, you know, new findings and new elements of EEG that maybe hadn't been reported on before that allow us to make Muse more powerful, but also generate some insights that are really useful for brain health research.
Yeah, it reminds me of Apple Computer and the health research that they're now able to do because so many people, like myself, have an Apple Watch. So that's an exciting area, and you're playing in a similar space.
It really is exciting. We're very fortunate to be here, and we have some great collaborators from around the world who are really excited about this. So, I'm hopeful that in the maybe medium to long term, what we'll see fall out of this is new measures of brain health that will allow us to intervene earlier. One of the big challenges in maintaining brain health as you age is detecting problems early enough so that you can intervene. Uh-huh. So if we can do a little bit better at that and get people on the right track early enough, detect problems and help them optimize their brain health. So even, you know, going beyond just thinking about it in terms of health and illness, if we can help people to optimize their brain health for performance at whatever it is that they want to be best at, that's really a positive potential outcome of using data at this scale and using technology at this scale. And I think it's not far off.
I wonder if this could perhaps be an early warning system for people with dementia or Alzheimer's that would end, you know, kind of be the canary in the mine, so to speak.
Yeah, that's we actually have a couple projects on that right now. So we're working with one of the big hospitals for elderly patients up here in Toronto, where we're based. Baycrest Hospital is one of the world leaders in neurodegenerative disease research. So we've got a fantastic collaboration up there with the memory clinic, and they're going to be using Muse to test people on their first visit to the memory clinic, and then some number of weeks or months later. And they'll be trying different interventions, behavioral and lifestyle interventions, and seeing if we can detect changes with using just a home-based EEG tool like Muse.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really promising avenue of research, and, you know, hopefully we'll get there.
Yeah, I could see where it could be both diagnostic, but also provide some kind of remediation or treatment by presenting the person with tasks to keep them sharp, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, mindfulness is a great way to keep your brain young. You know, meditation practice is the literature on this, the scientific literature is very strong, I think, to the extent that it suggests that the brains of meditators, long-term meditators, look anatomically and functionally younger than non-meditators.
That's very, very encouraging to me to hear that. Were you a meditator before you got involved with Muse?
I was a failed meditator, and I think I'm not a failed meditator anymore.
Uh-huh.
I suppose you know, if you really think about it and you get philosophical, there's no threshold for success. So I suppose I'm still probably a failed meditator, maybe a little less failed than before.
Uh-huh. Okay. And another thing that I've been very interested in, because I'm also interested in what's being called the third wave of psychedelic research, and I don't know if you are following that at all or not, but there's speculation about the relationship between the default network of the brain and some of the experiences that people have under the influence of LSD or other psychedelics. Have you looked into that at all? Are you thinking about that?
I'm not up to speed on the sort of bleeding edge of it. I have read some interesting papers. I think it's, you know, when you see to my mind, the efficacy of some of these psychedelics in mental health, now that we're back in the, as you say, the third wave of this, is so remarkable that it's hard not to look back on all of these lost years and say, my goodness, we could have been doing so much.
Yeah, right.
But at least we're here now.
Right.
And you know, one of the things that there are some really, really interesting papers coming out of mainstream neuroscience research labs looking at psychedelics like ayahuasca and LSD and even some things, you know, beyond the sort of MDMA, LSD mainstream in psychedelics, mental health research, that are very encouraging and promising. And it's, you know, we've had so little success in drugs to treat and improve the central nervous system, particularly psychiatric drugs for so many decades, that to finally have this new class of, or this old new, category of potential treatments or therapeutics is really promising.
Yeah. Yeah. Very exciting, I think. What else did I want to ask you here? Why don't you share with our audience what Muse 2 brings to the party beyond Muse 1?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So we noticed a couple of things when we went in to do some of this research that I talked about with Muse 1. And one of the things we noticed was that we seem to be seeing a signal in the accelerometer sensor, the movement sensor in the Muse, that looked like a heartbeat. So it turned out we could actually pick up people's heartbeats from the movement of their head, even while they sat quite, you know, in a tranquil meditative position.
Mm-hmm.
So what that encouraged us to do was to go and look at what we could do with these kinds of biosignals that we were pulling out by accident or that were byproducts of some of the sensors that we had built into the original Muse. And that led us into looking at more classical forms of biofeedback, looking at the heart, looking at breathing. So we can use, now we have a cardiac sensor called a photoplethysmograph, which is the same thing that's on your Apple Watch. It shines a light and it sees that the mechanical flow of blood past through the arteries in your systemic circulation. So it's right up here on the forehead next to the electroencephalography sensors, the EEG sensors on the Muse. And it picks up blood flow and we can see in real time blood flow. So we can actually play someone's heartbeat back to them as a form of biofeedback.
Yeah.
Now the interesting thing about playing someone's heartbeat back to them is that there's a literature out there, a scientific literature that says that people who are better able to perceive their internal sensations, what we call interoception, so perception of the interior of the body,
right.
Interoception, have different personality characteristics. They have a higher degree of empathy. They have a different kind of emotional reactivity. I don't know how robust that some of those results are, but one of the things that we wanted to do was to give our users the opportunity to experiment with listening to the sounds of their own body, their heartbeat, their breathing, and giving them forms of biofeedback, sort of a mix between classical and experimental, that would allow them to breathe in phase and to listen to their heartbeats and to, you know, use breathing to accelerate and decelerate their heartbeats, what's called the sinus arrhythmia, and move the soundscape around in a compelling way. So the hope is that this is going to help people who are using Muse to get in touch with their bodies a little bit better and, you know, maybe improve their relationship with their body and listen to what it's trying to tell them by listening to the processes, the physiological processes that go on in the background all of the time.
Now, are you aware of a group called HeartMath?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and they've done a lot of research. And
they've done some really interesting things with heart rate variability biofeedback,
Right. And so does your device, does Muse 2 measure heart rate variability?
We can, so not in real time. We are working on some experimental features in the hopes that we'll be able to roll some of those out. Not necessarily real-time heart rate variability, but maybe scoring it. It's a little bit more difficult to measure heart rate variability with a light-based sensor like the one on the Apple Watch, the PPG, than it is with an ECG. So an ECG is, they actually have those on the Apple Watch now too, but ECG is the electrical heart signal. And it's much more precise in terms of the timing of the event of the heartbeat. So it gives you a better signal-to-noise ratio and an easier to measure and easier to build an experience on that. So these are all things that we're thinking about for future Muses. And we're also working on developing from the data that our users share with us some new tools to give back to them to augment the experience.
Yeah, there's another company that I'm doing some work with that is using a heart rate, you know, a chest band to measure heart rate stuff. And
there are a number of different ways of measuring it. And, you know, one of the most recent tools that I really like is, there's a ring made by a Finnish company, Oura, O-U-R-A, and it measures heart rate variability overnight as you sleep, on the arterial blood flow on your finger, because it's just a very relatively small ring. And it uses that information to then prompt you to change your daytime behavior to improve your sleep. So it's a really fascinating way of kind of nudging people toward better sleep.
Huh. Yeah, I need to look into that more. I was aware of it. I've been to a kind of an event where there were some representatives from the company, but I didn't spend enough time on that. So you're using an accelerometer because the head kind of is pulsing.
The Muse 1, we use the accelerometer. In Muse 2, we actually put a heart rate sensor in there. So we can measure heart in real time with a photoplethysmograph. So that's the same thing that's on your Apple Watch, yeah.
Yeah, that's what you said. Okay, is there anything that we haven't spoken about here? Well, I guess I would want you to underscore a little bit that there are two populations of people that are using Muse, as I understand it. One are sort of regular people who are interested in meditation.
And then the other is there's a great big group of people who are using Muse for neuroscience research. Research outside of the laboratory and neuroscience education at the undergraduate level.
The other group that I was thinking of was therapists, psychotherapists, who are using it as a biofeedback device to give to their clients, patients, to help them become more calm, to be aware of what's going on in their brain, etc.
We discovered this. Yeah, we discovered this with we'd spoken to a number of psychologists and psychotherapists who I think there was a real absence of ways of getting your patients involved in a mindfulness practice or helping them learn meditation. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people were looking for a solution, and Muse is one of the solutions that they found. So there's quite a large population of clinicians and psychologists and psychotherapists, psychiatrists even, who are promoting the use of Muse to their patients. So they'll either loan it or, you know, they'll use it in clinic. One of the things we've heard again and again is that if I get someone to do this in my waiting room, then they come in much more ready to spend an hour and a half with me in our session. So that was very encouraging. And we've built some tools to support that for clinicians who are using Muse with multiple different patients. So we have done some support on that. And we have a professionals program that that tries to address some of the needs of psychologists and psychotherapists.
Yeah, so you've created a kind of community with two-way feedback that they are.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, which sounds like a wonderful development. And it sounds like this your company is poised in such a way that it may go take you to unexpected places, unexpected findings, and maybe other sorts of devices.
Yeah, that's the hope. Is we've built a powerful technology that other people are using for their own purposes, whether it's research or education or therapy or for personal use. So the great thing about a technology platform like that is that you don't necessarily have to see where your users are going to take you. You can find out by the developments that the community leads you toward. So that's a very promising and hopeful development for us, and we're eagerly and closely attuned to our users so that we can learn from them and continue to improve the technology for them.
Yeah, great. Well, I wish I could pass this glass of water to you that I have here, because I noticed you've been getting dry.
Yeah, I should have brought a glass of water myself.
Is there anything else that you'd like to say as we begin to wrap things up?
No, I think we've covered a lot of ground here, and it's been a real pleasure to chat with you. So, I'd be happy to come back in a year or two when we have some new technology in the market and talk about what we're hoping to do then.
Yeah, I'll look forward to that. And I want to let people know that I do have an affiliate relationship with you guys such that my listeners can get a discount. So I'll talk about that more later on in this show. But that aside, I think this is so fascinating and important that I was eager to speak with you, and not doing it to advertise the device particularly. That's just a byproduct of what we're doing here. So I want to thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
I really have to admire today's guest, Dr. Graham Moffitt. I think he's created such an interesting professional life for himself. He's ideally positioned himself in the nexus of some of the most exciting technological developments and possibilities of the day. Brain science, brain interfaces to the outside world, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, augmented reality, biofeedback, neurofeedback, consciousness, and more. Plus, he's at the forefront of what I'll call psych tech, researching how all these technologies might be used to diagnose and even treat our nervous system maladies, as well as giving us mastery over our inner world. All of this really speaks to that part of me that used to imagine becoming an electrical engineer and inventor. But then I remind myself how lucky I am not only to witness all these exciting developments, but to be able to speak with the pioneers such as Dr. Moffitt. But reflexive technophile that I've always been, I'm increasingly aware of the shadow side of technology and all the unintended negative consequences it has unleashed upon the planet. Too many to catalog here. Mythic notions such as Pandora's box, the Pied Piper, and double-edged swords come to mind. In fact, I had intended to ask Graham if he ever reflected on the dark side of these mind technologies, and if any keep him awake at night. Right after the interview was over, I realized the omission. Unconsciously motivated amnesia on my part? Very possibly. Also a reluctance to introduce a dark note into the upbeat vision he was sharing? A sense that it would be impolite of me? I also learned some things. I had been under the mistaken impression that the heart monitoring function of the Muse 2 would focus on heart rate variability, a hot topic these days that I've discussed in our monthly newsletter recently. I also didn't realize that they were using the same technology as in the latest Apple Watch to track the heartbeat, a tiny laser non-invasively peering through the skin. Another unexpected learning for me was his disclosure that the Muse technology was not originally focused on meditation training at all, but rather on trying to develop a thought-controlled virtual reality keyboard for entering text. That was a surprise. Another surprise was his relative humility in admitting that as a meditation trainer, the Muse is most valuable to beginning meditators and those trying to establish the discipline of a regular practice. The Muse gives you feedback as to how long a streak you are on, that is, how many days of unbroken meditation sessions you've racked up. I found that gentle feedback useful myself. At the end of the interview, you heard me mention that as a listener, you can get a discount on either the original Muse or the Muse 2. I do recommend that you get either the original Muse or the Muse 2. Either one is a terrific value. You'll have a four-channel EEG at a price that would have been unimaginable just a couple of years ago. And if you're a therapist, it's almost a must-have tool to introduce into your practice, and there's a supportive community of other therapists to learn from and to be guided by. So whichever device you decide on, you can get a 15% discount. The easiest way to take advantage of this is to go to my website at shrinkwrapradio.com and scroll down the homepage until you're almost at the bottom. And you'll come to a panel labeled Important Links. And there you'll see a blue-green banner ad that reads Muse Brain Sensing Mindfulness Trainer. Click on that, and you'll see the needed information to get your Muse.
Hi, this is Dr. Ralph Wilson. I wanted to let you know that I'm so impressed with your work that I literally tell every patient I see that they ought to log into shrinkwrapradio.com and get the latest in anything that's concerning what's going on in their life. You can find almost anything at Shrink Wrap Radio. And thanks for being there, Dave. I won't let you take a whole lot longer on this spot, but thanks, Dr. Dave. Bye for now.
Thank you, Dr. Ralph Wilson, for being such a longtime listener and for encouraging other listeners to support Shrink Wrap Radio. Before closing off, I'd like to recommend the web hosting company that I use for this show. I've been using them for some years for two very important reasons. One, they're quite inexpensive. The Shrink Wrap Radio website is huge because of 15 years of past episodes and transcripts on the site. Yet Bluehost manages the whole thing, plus my market research website, for an extremely competitive rate. Number two, they provide 24/7 voice support, phone support, and that's almost unheard of these days. I need to talk to a person when I have a problem, and their tech support people are native English speakers. This is really unheard of these days, and they know the answers I'm seeking. So if you have a website or are going to get one, this is the hosting company for you. And if you already are using a different hosting company, check out the pricing and service at Bluehost.com, and you'll probably discover it's worth switching. And they'll make it easy to do, no matter how big your site is. In fact, that's what I did some years back. I switched to them. And you can help support Shrink Wrap Radio by going to www.bluehost.com/track/shrinkwrapradio. That's all one word. So that they know who referred you. So with that, I think I'll wrap it up for today. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Graham Moffitt of choosemuse.com, for telling us about the cutting edge of psych tech. And next week, I'll be speaking with plastic surgeon Mark B. Constantin about his book, Childhood Abuse, Body Shame, and Addictive Surgery. And we'll be discussing the dangers of seeking out unnecessary plastic surgery. I'm certain you'll find it fascinating. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.